KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, we split the hour ahead with focus on the Middle East. In the first segment, we'll be joined by UCLA professor and author Sari Makdisi, the author of Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. Then we talk to veteran war correspondent Martin Fletcher, who presently serves as NBC News Bureau Chief in Tel Aviv and is the author of Breaking News. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Sari Makdisi joins us for this opening half hour. He's professor of English and Comparative Literature at UCLA, and he's published commentaries on the Middle East that have appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Houston Chronicle, and Al Nahar in Beirut. And he has written pieces on the Arab-Israeli conflict for The Nation and the London Review of Books. His recently published book is called Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. And he joins us for this opening Forum segment. And welcome. Good morning.
Thank you.
Should also mention, full disclosure here, that you are Edward Said's nephew, or Edward Said was your uncle, because I know there are many people out there who were admirers of Edward Said. Here you are, an American citizen, writing about Palestine and seeing the occupied territories firsthand and seeing what you call the background music of the occupation, the everyday kind of hoops and permits and passes and curfews and closures that people have to go through. And as an outsider and as an American of Arabic background, in terms of your own descent, you were pretty appalled.
I was appalled, and what appalled me most was my realization that the way in which the conflict is covered here in the U.S. doesn't do justice, or that's maybe the wrong word in this case, but it doesn't do justice to what's going on the ground. We tend to get caught up in the U.S. especially with events when they turn to large scale violence, and when there isn't large scale violence, we don't notice what's going on. And what I discovered in the book was that to understand what's going on there, you really have to understand what's happening on a day-to-day basis. The bureaucracy of the occupation is something that works day in and day out, whereas, you know, rocket attacks or reprisals or tanks or whatever, those are things that happen much more irregularly, although they're the ones that take all the attention. And to understand what's happening, you need to understand what it's like for farmers who can't get to their land because of bureaucratic controls over them, for women who can't get to hospital to give birth, for parents who can't find their children, for kids who can't get to school, for doctors who can't get to their hospitals and so on. That's the reality of life for Palestinians living under occupation. And it's something that we need to know more about in order to understand the logic of the occupation.
Well, you talk early on about family unification applications, 120,000 since 2000. And you go so far as to say that you believe Israeli policy is set up to break up the family.
It's not what I say. It's what human rights organizations, including the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, says. I mean, the Israeli policy is designed to make it as difficult as possible, first of all, for Palestinians to return to Palestinian territory from the outside, and second of all, for Palestinians to move between the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem and Israel itself, plus the outside world, to come and go. So, for example, there's a law that the Israelis passed in 2003 that they've renewed every year since 2003 that was given the High Court's blessing in 2006 that prevents Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel who marry Palestinians from the occupied territories from living together. So basically, if you're a Palestinian and you're a citizen of the State of Israel and you marry another Palestinian who's from the West Bank, let's say, you're not allowed to live together by the State of Israel. It only applies by the Palestinians. It doesn't apply, for example, to Jewish settlers. So somebody who's Jewish, a Jewish citizen of the State of Israel who marries somebody who's Jewish who lives in a settlement in the West Bank, let's say, they can come and go. They can live together either in the West Bank or in Israel. But if you're Palestinian, you're not allowed to cross those borders so easily, even if you're married to a citizen of the state. Those kinds of forms of control over who can live where I think, say a lot about what's at stake in the conflict as far as the Israelis are concerned.
Well, you start with a man named Sam Bahour, who is a U.S.-born Palestinian.
Yeah.
You know, you tell his story. Why is that important to you?
Because he's somebody who went back. He's an American Palestinian who went back in the mid-1990s, sort of at the peak of the Oslo peace process, when things looked especially hopeful. And so his idea was to move back and to contribute to the founding of a Palestinian state in the occupied territories. And to, you know, he's a businessman, so to bring business acumen and knowledge and capital and so forth. And what happened was he got caught in this trap where after he married a Palestinian woman living in the West Bank, they applied for what's called family unification. In other words, the right to live together as a married couple, which is something that all states grant to people under those circumstances. And even though they're living in the West Bank, Israel still retains control over the population registry of the West Bank. In fact, it retains control over the population registry in Gaza, too, even though it withdrew from Gaza. It withdrew its settlers from Gaza in 2005. So what that meant was that in order for Sam to live with his wife and eventually their kids, they had to get permission from Israel, even though they were living on Palestinian land as Palestinians in Palestinian territory. But Israel retains control over that. And so he ended up having to live, like thousands of others of Palestinians, on the basis of getting renewable visas, basically. So he would get a visa, and then 3 months would go by, and he'd go back and come back. And it was coming and going on these renewable three-month visas, basically. That's how he's been living for 10 or 15 years now. And like for him, like for everybody else, the process of granting the right to live with your spouse, if you're Palestinian, is not easily granted by the Israeli government.
We're talking again, if you've just joined us, with Sari Makdisi, discussing his recent book, Palestine Inside Out, which is a first-hand account of daily life for the Palestinian people. And I should mention that my guest has also written a number of, well, it's in his book as well, but columns, editorials, saying essentially a two-state solution is no longer viable, and advocating a single democratic secular state, which certainly is something that would seem, well, particularly at this point, impossible in terms of Israeli politics.
Yeah, it may look impossible, but if you look at all the historical circumstances where things seemed impossible, then they suddenly become possible. You know, things change. If you looked at South Africa in the late 1980s, you wouldn't have thought, hey, presto, within 10 years, there's going to be a black South African president. I mean, it's quite remarkable the way...
Or I always use the example of Glasnost and Perestroika.
And Glasnost and the fall of the Berlin Wall. All these things that happened. Or look at what has happened in the U.S. The remarkable changes can happen in all kinds of situations. And there's nothing to lead us to believe that the situation in Israel-Palestine is from, you know, it's from outer space. It's like they're people like any other kind of people, basically. But the two-state solution, you know, which is predicated on the creation of a Palestinian state in the occupied territories, the main problem with it is that at this point, according to the UN, Israeli infrastructure, which is off-limits to Palestinians, now takes up about 40% of the West Bank. And all of East Jerusalem as well. So what that means is that the ground on which one might even think about there being a Palestinian state is being taken away from under the feet of the Palestinians. So this is 60% of the West Bank is left to them, but it's 60% that's broken up into bits and pieces of discontinuous territory. So to get from one island of territory to another within their own, supposedly their own space, Palestinians have to pass through a network of Israeli-controlled roads and bridges and tunnels and checkpoints and so forth.
Well, there's an article in today's paper about an international news organization is campaigning to end the present policy of barring reporters from actually even entering Gaza.
For example, yeah. So all these forms of control basically make it impossible to think of this ever becoming a kind of state. What would a state look like that's actually like an archipelago of islands? You know, all access to the outside world is controlled by another power, and all access, in fact, from one island to another is also controlled by the same outside power.
But what I'm really asking at this point is there really the political will, either in Israel or, for that matter, from leaders like Abbas, although I don't know what kind of clout he has. Maybe, in fact, one could argue that Hamas has much more clout politically.
It's not.
Would Hamas be willing to make a single state solution?
The established leaders on both sides of the equation aren't interested in a one state solution. I mean, certainly Palestinian, the official Palestinian leadership certainly isn't. And if you think of why it isn't, it's because right now, as a class, they have privileges that they would give up if there was a one state solution. And similarly with the Israelis, they're not for a one state solution. And the reason why is because there's no pressure on them from the outside to want to conceive of a state in which all human beings are treated equally, in which all citizens have the same kinds of rights. And historically speaking, again, it's interesting to look at history and think of all the examples of where this kind of democratizing process has taken place, from 19th century Britain to 19th and 20th century America to South Africa and so on. And it's just historically been the case that privileged groups don't voluntarily renounce their privileges just because they feel bad one day. They renounce their privileges when they're compelled to renounce their privileges.
Usually, also the general fear, though. I'd have to bring that into the calculus. I mean, there's fear on both sides, as far as security and as far as being dehumanized, with good reason on both sides. And I can't help sort of coming back to the point that you come back to, which is a very small minority, maybe, are terrorists who want to blow themselves up. However, you've got this majority of people in the occupied territories, for many of the reasons that you cite in the book, who feel that this is good. They countenance it.
What?
Suicide bombing, in other words.
No, I think most. I mean, it's been shown over and over again. Most Palestinians aren't interested in suicide bombing, and they're not. They're like human beings anywhere else in the world. What they want to do is to get on with their lives, to educate their children, to be able to go to work, to live a normal life, to be able to live with their husbands and wives and children and so forth.
That's certainly true, but that sort of evades, I think, the polls that show that there is majority support, actually, for suicide bombings. I mean, time and again, I've seen those polls.
I haven't seen those polls, but even if they existed, the point is we have to understand what has been driving this conflict. And what's been driving the conflict is the sense that one people's rights can be established at the expense of another people.
So actually, in the book, you say it's all about land.
It's about land. It's about removing one population to make room for another population. And the population that's being removed is saying, hang on, we don't want to go. This is our land, too. And the population that's removing them, and has been doing so since 1948, is saying, well, we don't understand why you're so upset that we're removing you. And if you just step back and think, well, what would happen to you if somebody came to your house and threw you out of your house? Would you just go away quietly because they said your house is theirs? No, you would offer some kind of resistance, good resistance, bad, right, wrong. The point is the resistance is generated by what's happening to these people. So if we don't like bombings or shell attacks or rocket attacks, you know, or anything, or aerial bombardment and so forth, we have to understand where those things are coming from. They're not coming out of the sky. They're coming out of a human context. And to address them, one has to address the context, which is to say, one has to say that it's impossible for one people to find its security at the expense of another people. There'll never be security in a situation like that. So in order for there to be security for both peoples have to have access to their full spectrum of human rights. And then we can talk about security in the context of equal rights, full justice for everybody, and not the exclusion or the destruction of one community for the sake of another.
Talking to Sari Makdisi, his new book is Palestine Inside Out, An Everyday Occupation. Let me open the phone lines. There are many of you who may want to weigh in here with your own thoughts or sentiments, and you're certainly welcome to do that, or perhaps bring up some questions as well to my guests. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that toll-free number, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite, is 866-733-6786. You can also send an email, and we welcome your email as well, and try to get them on the air here. It's forum@kqed.org if you'd like to send an email to us. During the Bush administration, 2006, you cite that there were 78 days of comprehensive closure of the West Bank.
Yeah. Yeah. What that means is that the entire West Bank is shut down. So Palestinians can't move, sometimes within their own town. Certainly they can't move from town to town, from village to village. The farmers can't get to their fields. Parents can't take their kids to school. Nobody comes, nobody goes, if you're a Palestinian. If you're a Jewish settler, you come and go as usual. So in other words, closure only applies to one population, not to the other population. And in fact, the closures and other mechanisms like that are designed in order to enable the freedom of movement of one population at the expense of another. And that's the case with all the forms of bureaucratic control in the West Bank. You have to remember, in the West Bank, there are two different road networks and two different legal and administrative systems for two different populations. So the kind of law to which you're subject depends on whether you're a Palestinian or a Jewish settler. If you're a Jewish settler, you're subject to Israeli civil law, for example. If you're a Palestinian, you're subject to Israeli military law. And obviously, you can imagine civil law is one thing and very harsh military law is another thing. They're two different legal systems that impinge on your life according to whether you're a Palestinian or a Jewish settler.
And the poverty, of course, is almost beyond the pale.
Yeah, the poverty is strangling, and it, again, has to do with the fact that people can't move things around. I mean, in, there's a network of 630 Israeli army roadblocks and checkpoints and blockades and so forth throughout the West Bank, which isn't a very large territory, as you can imagine. So 630 of these obstacles cutting off all the main roads, cutting all the towns from each, off from each other, means that goods don't circulate, let alone labor, people, etc. No, nothing moves, or it moves very slowly and at great expense.
You know the argument, though, I'm sure. This is a Jewish state. It came out of the ashes. It's Palestinians were displaced and removed from the land, and that's why land has to be returned to them. And the best way to reconcile that, I mean, like, it's a problem that's often analogized to Indians, let's say. You know, it's a Jewish state. This is America. We can give them casinos or do something, you know, to redeem the past. But it remains an American country. Can't give it back to the Indians. And so the argument goes, can't give it back to the Palestinians. Because if you have one state, you'll have a hegemonic Arab state or Palestinian state because just of numbers. I mean, that's how the argument goes.
Well, that's an argument that takes a great deal of emphasis from a fear of population. So and as you know, in Israel there's a great deal of talk about the demographic threat, the demographic time bomb, and so on and so forth. And the reason why demography is such an issue, the reason why people even worry about the status of how many Palestinians there are inside the state, what would happen to the two populations of the mix, etc., and the preponderance of Jews to non-Jews, etc., is because Israel is a state that wants to claim to be the Jewish state. And from the beginning, the problem has been for the Jewish state that there are all these non-Jews in it. And so the question is, what do you do with them? How do you have a Jewish state that has all these non-Jews living?
Well,
in
you
it?
Establish a separate state for those people who are removed from the land is the argument, of course. But that's something that you're countering by saying it's a failure and it's not going to work.
It's not that it's a failure. It's that it's wrong to remove people from their own homeland because you want to create a different kind of state where they happen to live. So that's why I think the one-state solution offers for both peoples the sense that everybody who's there is there to stay. And the point is that you can't have one population having rights that are denied to another. That's the problem.
Well, let's hear what our listeners have to say. We'll begin with you, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I think you absolutely can have rules for one population versus another. For instance, let's say Canadians, for whatever reason, we were fighting over some territory and they were sending in suicide bombers. Who in the U.S. wouldn't want to stop it? Who wouldn't want to put up a wall? Who wouldn't say that all Canadians have different rights than U.S. citizens? So I think the whole argument is ridiculous. Thank you very much for taking my comment.
All right. Thank you for your call. Sareem Akhtishi.
Well, I'm not entirely sure I understand what the guy is saying, but first of all, Canada.
He's talking about threats, really.
Yeah, but the point is Canada.
Security.
Sure, but Canada is a different country. We're talking about a land which, at the beginning of the 20th century, had a population that was 93% non-Jewish. So the idea that one can establish a Jewish state in a land that has historically had a Jewish, Muslim, and Christian character involves violence. And what has happened since then is the reaction to that violence, the consequences of that violence. So that's what I'm saying. The project of trying to create a homogeneous state in what had been historically a heterogeneous land, the way to stop that is not to say, well, there's all this counter-violence as a result of what is necessarily a violent project, but rather to say the people should live together as equals. And that's difficult for some people to understand, but it doesn't seem that far-fetched to me.
We go to Palo Alto. Valerie, hi.
Hi. I traveled in that area with a group called Interfaith Peace Builders last April, and I think we were all appalled by what we saw, the Israeli-Jewish treatment of the Palestinians. This is a tiny, tiny country. And, you know, it's about as big as the Bay Area. Israel is a tiny, tiny country. And when you look at the Israeli settlements, which are supported by American dollars, they are like little enclaves in Switzerland villages, little cantons, you know, surrounded by greenery. Then when you go where the Palestinians live, it's all tan, you know, a horribly dry landscape. I think that in as much as the Jewish people suffered a whole lot during World War II, they ought to be treating these Palestinians better. And we even talked to a man who has written a book, and he was on Terry Gross's show with his co-author, a Palestinian and a Jew, and they wrote about this man's, I think it was an 11-year-old daughter, who was killed. He talked to our group, and he said, "Friends, an American bullet killed my daughter." Would you address all that? Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Sorry, Mike Deasy.
Well, I mean, the question about what happened to the Jewish people, it's true. The crimes perpetrated against the Jewish people by the Nazis, well, by Europeans in general for hundreds of years, and by the Nazis in particular during World War II and the Holocaust, obviously, it should be, I think, Europeans who pay the price for what they did, and Germans in particular. So the idea that Palestinians should pay the price for somebody else's crimes, I think, is just, you know, it's misplaced. That seems pretty obvious. And then, I mean, obviously, I think, as I said, that I think people should live together in a situation where nobody has rights that cancel out those of others.
Lori, you're our next caller. Welcome.
Thank you. What your author is not acknowledging is that thousands and thousands of Jews were expelled from Iraq, Iran, and other Middle Eastern countries. Are you also advocating that these countries reinstate residency and land ownership for those Jews who were expelled? And if you're not, then your argument is fallacious, and you are not advocating equal treatment for Jews as well as Palestinians.
I there's no question that, of course, anybody who's Jewish who's expelled from an Arab country, I think, also has the right to go home. But my point is, I believe firmly in the universal set of human rights that apply to all human beings. I don't think anybody should be discriminated against because of who they are or their background. So, of course, Jews should have the right to go back to Arab countries. Of course, they shouldn't have been thrown out to begin with. And there's a long history to that, too. And that shouldn't have happened. There's no question about it. But, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, obviously. I think both sets of things are wrong, and we need to address them both.
Thank Lori. And Jason, your turn next. Good morning.
Hi. Am I on?
You're on.
Oh, okay. Hi. I'm an Israeli Jew, and so I guess that my opinion would be somewhat biased. But I think that the issue is really using those Israeli dollars and those American dollars to equal the playing field between the Palestinians and the Jews. I also think that sorry, I'm so nervous.
Okay, we'll say goodbye and we'll go to another caller. Chris, good morning.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, can hear you fine.
Oh, sorry about that. It just got stopped. I just wanted to say I've long been a supporter of the two-state solution. But as I learn more about both Israel and the West Bank, as an American, I become really uncomfortable with the notion that whether you become a citizen in Israel or what your rights are in Israel really depend on your religious background. And that's just not something I'm not comfortable with people advocating that in any country. I think we have a history in the U.S. of knowing that matters of religion and politics way, way, way far apart from each other. And so as I look at this, it makes me, surprisingly to myself, less comfortable with the two-state solution.
Chris, I thank you. Your line is getting a little bit indistinct, and let me go to a better line here. Matt, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, great.
You have to talk quite fast, though. We've got
Sure. I think one of the biggest barriers to, since the United States funds so much of, first of all, thank you for having this program and offering different perspectives on the occupation, because I think one of the biggest barriers is that the U.S. public doesn't have a lot of information about the reality, especially American Jews. I think a lot of the information they get is extremely biased, and so it creates this sort of
That's going to have to be the final note here, because we are flat out of time, but I want to thank Sari Makdisi for being with us again. His book is called Palestine Inside Out. Thank you so much for being
here. Thank you very much.
We're going to take a break for a couple minutes, as we generally do at the half-hour mark. When we come back, we're going to talk with Martin Fletcher, who is one of the world's best-known overseas reporters and correspondents. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're going to spend this half hour with Martin Fletcher, who is a television news correspondent. He's won 5 Emmys and many other honors for his work in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East. Over the past 3.5 decades, he's presently NBC bureau chief in Tel Aviv, Israel, and author of Breaking News, and had an opportunity to speak with him on stage last night at the Marin JCC, which puts on terrific events. And this is a man who has been just about to every revolution, war, and major conflict, natural disaster in the world. Many of you, of course, have seen him through the years on MSNBC and on NBC, and Welcome, Martin Fletcher. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
I thought actually we'd begin by talking about, well, one state solution versus two state solution. You're situated in Tel Aviv, and you've certainly been very much on top of the story. What are your thoughts?
Well, the problem is, I think that the more, you know, the more desperate the situation becomes, the more desperate the solutions become, the potential solutions. And the problem with the idea of a one-state solution is it ain't going to happen. Clearly, Israel is not going to allow a joint Israeli-Palestinian state. So attractive as it may seem to people who don't see any other way forward, as a political option, it's a red herring because it's not going to happen. So I think one has to really stick with reality and try to work out solutions based on what's possible.
But you heard Sarid Magdisi say, what about South Africa? Whoever would have imagined black leadership in South Africa? Or I mentioned glasnost and perestroika. In other words, impossible things seem to happen.
They do. And, you know, as Ben-Gurion said, to be a realist in Israel, you have to believe in miracles. I was in South Africa during the struggle for apartheid, and I was also in Berlin when the wall came down. And I spent months afterwards traveling the East Bloc, studying the economies for NBC. And the fact is that in the 4 years I spent in Southern Africa, in Rhodesia and South Africa, it was clear to me anyway, and to most people actually, apart from the white leadership, that ultimately there would be black majority rule in Southern Africa. It was a historical process that could not be stopped. In the same way, communism, as a political process and economic process, clearly had a limit to its viability in the struggle with the West. Jewish control of the West Bank, Israeli control of the West Bank is fairly total. Gaza is so totally cut off, the divide between Hamas in Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank is so strong that the only way forward is to try to bring the groups together in a political process that has a potential of succeeding, not to go for a solution that cannot work.
I mentioned also in the interview I had this previous segment that reporters are presently barred from Gaza. In fact, I mean, how do you feel about that as a correspondent?
Personally, I'm delighted. It's too dangerous, but I say that facetiously. There's actually a movement right now. I've been asked to sign a letter yesterday. A petition from the foreign press to overrule that ruling by the Israelis. No, the media has to have free access to Gaza.
Your story, and it is quite a story, I mean, son of survivors, coming increasingly aware through the human suffering you saw in places like Rwanda and Turkey and in Cyprus, actually, and throughout Africa, the Horn of Africa, as well as South Asia, becoming increasingly aware of just how extraordinary human suffering is in so many places that, well, Americans, Israelis, people in Europe are not even privy to or aware of on a day-to-day level. And the other side of your story is actually sitting down with people who are, I mean, you live in Tel Aviv, your children are in Tel Aviv, you're sitting down with suicide bombers who could have been responsible for easily the death of your loved ones.
Yeah, that's a dilemma, you know. I mean, I've been in Israel now. I've been reporting from Israel for 26 years. And my first assignment there was in 1973. And it's a very important part of the way I see my job is, on the one hand, to report on the victims of suicide bombs during the Second Intifada, but at the same time, as an NBC News reporter, to go to meet the people who do it as far as I can, tell their story as fairly as possible. Which was a dilemma because, of course, I, like everybody else living in Israel at the time, had children who could have been blown up on the way to school or in cafes, and we had friends who were blown up. And then I would then go the next day to interview people who sent them from the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Nablus. So there was a dilemma. But I think as a reporter, it's my job to be as fair as possible to both sides, and that means knowing both sides.
And you are upfront about the fact that you are Jewish with these members of the Al-Aqsa Brigade that you talk to and so forth? Yeah,
they always ask at some point in the conversation, what religion are you? And I always tell the truth, yeah.
And this has not been an impediment.
It hasn't, no. As a matter of fact, I've never had a problem, certainly in West Bank or Gaza. I've always told everybody when they ask, Hamas, Fatah, anybody else, that I'm Jewish, and they've just been interested and accepted me. You know, there are plenty of Israeli journalists who go into the West Bank, circulating among the Palestinians, and as long as they know that you're fair, they accept you.
I mean, they read your stuff on the internet.
They do. They can check me on MSNBC.com, no problem.
How do you make contact with people like the Al-Aqsa Brigade?
Well, initially through Palestinian intermediaries. And then at a certain point, in particular with the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades that I got to know in Nablus, we became quite familiar. And I went to the home of the mother of the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Balata refugee camp and became quite familiar with that family, actually. It was a bit, you know, it's a bit strange to be in the room with these guys when suddenly they hear news of a suicide bombing and that 12 Israelis have been killed, and they all jump up, Allah Akbar, wonderful, great, and you're sitting there thinking, oh my God, I hope nobody I knew was killed.
But the coverage of the occupied, so-occupied territories, I mean, technically Gaza's not occupied anymore, but I mean, there have been complaints. In fact, you're one of those correspondents who said that the story of Jenin, of the massacres supposedly in Jenin of Palestinians by Israelis, was way exaggerated beyond, I mean, fabric of fiction.
Yeah, well, the initial claim was that Israelis had killed 500 Palestinians in the Jenin refugee camp, and the Jenin refugee camp had been flattened and there was nothing left. And that actually came from UN sources. So journalists, you know, quite legitimately reported what the United Nations sources were saying. And we couldn't get in there because there was terrific fighting and the Israelis banned the press from getting in there. At a certain point, we sort of lost patience and walked through the fields for about 3 miles. And we were among the first to get into Jenin. But what we saw when we got there was that there was clearly no massacre. Certainly the center of the refugee camp had been flattened, but that was about the size of, say, a football field or two, not more than that. The rest of it was standing pristine. There had been very serious heavy fighting, but there was no massacre, and I reported that straight away.
Getting back for a moment to the two-state solution versus the one-state solution, is it fair to say, from your knowledge, that a two-state solution would be as unacceptable to Hamas leadership as a one-state solution would be to Israeli leadership?
That's a good question. Look, in the short term, Hamas has signed on to the idea of a two-state solution. The question is whether you believe them. And the Palestinians, many of the Palestinians, talk about what they call a two-stage solution. So the first stage of a two-stage solution, the first stage would be a two-state solution. But the second stage would then be, at some point in time, to begin the next stage, which is to take over all of Israel. And that Hamas is very upfront about. That's what they say. Whereas Fatah does not. Fatah says two-state solution, live in peace, secular democratic states next to each other. That's what the Fatah says they want. Hamas is very, very clear about its goal, which is to destroy Israel.
Sometimes when I think about the conflict in the Middle East, I honestly think, I mean, you're in Tel Aviv, and Tel Aviv seems in many ways like a European city almost. I mean, it is a very cosmopolitan city, and the specter haunts and continues to haunt Israelis of the European experience and of the Holocaust and so forth. But the specter of colonialism and of European colonialism continues to haunt the Palestinian people. It's as if both people can't get past those histories.
Yeah, and that's part of the tragedy. They can't get past those histories. And actually, I would say they shouldn't get past those histories because it's their history. They can't. And the question is, how do you make two narratives coincide or coexist in a way that shows respect to both sides? And I think that's the issue, that Israel has its burden of the Holocaust, and that should be respected by everybody. And the Palestinians have their need for their state, which should be respected by everybody. And the trick is to combine those narratives.
I'm going to also invite those of you listening to join us. In fact, if you have questions or comments, if you'd like to speak with our guest, Martin Fletcher, by all means, feel free to weigh in here. And you can do that toll-free. Our toll-free number is available to you and available whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Feel free to become part of this program. It's 866-733-6786. We're continuing to talk about the Middle East with Martin Fletcher, who's Tel Aviv correspondent and bureau chief for NBC and MSNBC. And again, our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. What would you say by way of, I mean, you've seen so much carnage, and it would be easy to a man of your perspective to have a great deal of pessimism. What can you say about the Middle East that is hopeful?
A lot. A lot. Actually, that what I try to get at in my book is that to this background of tremendous, you know, suffering and world events that I've seen worldwide for so long, one of the issues I try to deal with is the human condition. You know, what does it do when you witness all this stuff, and what does it do to be a victim of all this stuff? And you can, and I, you know, I basically have a choice whether to, you know, the half cup is the cup half empty or half full. I can choose to be intimidated and horrified by the evil doers, or I can be encouraged by the incredible resistance and will to survive and fight back of the victims. And you know, so I'm actually I'm a fairly optimistic type, and I think that in the Middle East there are so many problems. But they're mostly problems that could be solved with the right leadership. And it seems to me, especially among the Israelis and Palestinians, that it's a matter of the leadership, because it's clear.
Bankrupt on both sides?
Bankrupt on both sides. It's clear, and has been for a long time, that a majority of Palestinians and a majority of Israelis would agree to almost any deal on the table if it promised peace, because they've had it up to here with the conflict, Israelis and Palestinians. All the opinion polls show that.
When we talk about leadership in Israel, we're talking largely about a face-off between Bibi Netanyahu and
Tzipi Livni,
not Barak, not Ehud Barak, but still both who represent pretty much status quo to a more extreme in Netanyahu's case, but nevertheless status quo. And then are we really talking about leadership outside of Ramallah for Abbas?
No, we're not really. As a matter of fact, I mean, Abbas is the president. He rules in Ramallah, and his police, actually, with Israeli help and American training, are spreading their net into Hebron, and they did rather well in Nablus and Jenin. So they are spreading their power slowly, but he, as Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, as a leader, does not have much credibility among Palestinians outside Ramallah, and that makes it a problem when you're looking for somebody to talk peace with who represents the Palestinian people.
Hamas and Hezbollah have much more clout, you think?
Hamas in Gaza, Hezbollah in South Lebanon, of course, rule their own areas very strongly indeed. And one of the lessons we learned is that when an Islamic militant group attains political power, they do so with tremendous discipline and, frankly, inspiration for their own people. I mean, both Hamas and Hezbollah began their achievement of power through very strong social institutions, helping people who are sick, developing schools in an area where the established authorities, the South Lebanese government and the Palestinian people in the West Bank and Gaza, were bankrupt. They didn't help their own people. So Hamas, the Islamic militants stepped in and did a tremendous job. And then they translated that into then military power and ultimately political power.
Where is any comparable or parallel, say, moral strength or religious fiber in Israel, where religious zealots, for example, are free of conscription and don't have to serve in the military, and many of them are, constantly facing off with the state over theological quibbling of one sort or another? I mean, is there anything similar to that kind of movement? Maybe we keep hearing about how the young are so disillusioned in Israel, they want to leave, things are falling apart in terms of commitment to the state of Israel of the younger generation.
Well, you know, we hear about that, and actually I'm writing a second book which deals in part with motivation of the youth, so I've been studying this question, actually. And, you know, like any secular democratic country today, it's all about, you know, getting a good job and going on vacation, and that's in conflict with the reality of being an Israeli citizen today, because you've still got to do 3 years in the army, and if you're a fighter, you've then got to do reserve duty sometimes as much as 2 months a year. There is a crisis of dedication to the state, if you like. But having said that, the secular democratic youth who are in two minds about whether to serve or not are being replaced by religious boys and girls who are totally devoted to the state and to serving. So there's no shortage. I mean, the Israeli army, they always say they've got too many people.
But the Orthodox don't have to serve in the army.
The Orthodox don't have to serve, but there's sort of grades of orthodoxy, if you like, among Jews in Israel. And the sort of the black hat guys, the Haredim, don't serve. But religious people serve en masse.
Let me bring our callers in. And Quinn, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. My question was, Where are, if there are some, moderates in both of these governments? And would they be more likely to support a two-state or some sort of some sort of situation that would allow there to be peace between the two governments?
Well, you know, actually, the moderates within the governments, the moderates are in government, as a matter of fact, both among the Palestinians and the Israelis. I mean, at the moment, the governments are the moderates who are looking for, who are trying to achieve a two-state solution. But there are radicals on both sides who want to prevent any kind of compromise. You know, one person put it to me very nicely. I thought she was a woman who lost her daughter. Her daughter was killed in a suicide bombing, and she said that when the prime minister at the time, Bibi Netanyahu, telephoned her to express regrets, she wouldn't take his call. He said, "You're part of the reason why my daughter was killed." And she said she divides people in Israel and the West Bank and Gaza into two groups, not Arabs and Jews, but those who are willing to compromise for peace on both sides. There are many Arabs and many Jews who will compromise for peace, and there are others who won't. So she divides the group up in that way, not Arabs and Jews, but those willing to compromise for peace and those not willing to compromise for peace.
Hmm. Let me thank Quinn for the call, and we'll go next to James. Go ahead, Jamie.
Hi. I'm wondering if the Islamization of the Palestinian national movement came from the failure of secular Palestinian nationalists. Do you think that now, having been accepted as the, with Hamas being elected in, do you think a secular leader could come about with popular support from Palestinians?
Jamie, it's an interesting question because at the moment, of course, there is a secular leader, but Mahmoud Abbas, but he doesn't have the support of most of the Palestinians, even in the West Bank, and of certainly a very few in Gaza. All over the world in these situations I've been in, is militancy always develops where there's a lack of strong moderate leadership. When there's a vacuum, the militants fill it anywhere, and that's what's happened certainly in Gaza. And the West Bank right now, there's a very strong grab for power by Mahmoud Abbas, as I said before, with the help of the Israeli military and with training from the Americans for his police force. So the battle for secular power in the West Bank is very much underway, and right now they're winning.
Whoever would have thought it, U.S. and Israel combining to help Fatah become a power. Mazen, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. I have two questions. The first is, given Prime Minister Olmert's comments last month about the need for withdrawal from the West Bank, why hasn't Israel taken steps towards withdrawing? What's stopping them? And the second question is, Prime Minister Rabin said, you don't make peace with your friends, you make peace with your enemies. So why doesn't Israel speak to Hamas?
Well, that's a good question. The same question is, why doesn't America speak to the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, for instance? And I think that's, you know, it's hard to make that leap to talk peace with people who are actually trying to kill you. You have to set some sort of moral standards of leadership, I guess. In general, you're right. You make peace with your enemies. But there comes a point at which that's a part of a process that has to go its own way.
Israel sees now its biggest enemy in many ways is Iran. And what I was struck by, and I should mention that my guest, Martin Fletcher, was, I think, one of the first let into the U.S. Embassy during the takeover in Tehran.
I was actually the only journalist to get in while the hostages were there, against my will, I might add.
Yeah, but you did get in there. I mean, like I say, you're the man. You've been so many places. It's really extraordinary. But you look at Iran as not the kind of threat that at least Israel seems to look at Iran as being.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if Iran gets the nuclear bomb, the whole game changes. But it's a long way. It's still a long way for that to happen. And the Iranian people in general do not support their own leadership, and certainly not the extreme positions of Ahmadinejad. And there was a TV program in Iran which just finished a series about an Iranian diplomat during the Second World War who was issuing visas to Jews in Paris in order to save them from the Nazis. And that has been a hit series on Iranian TV to a country in which 65% of the people are under the age of 25. And for most of those people, it was the first time they'd ever heard of the Holocaust. and it was presented to them in a way that was favorable to Iranian-Jewish relations. And I think that says a lot about the potential for the success of negotiation and sanctions as opposed to just threats of war.
You also spent a lot of time in South Asia and Pakistan and areas around Afghanistan and in Afghanistan. I'm wondering what you think about what seems to be an Obama policy is taking shape to move things out of Iraq and to have General Petraeus and use the same kind of paradigm or model in Afghanistan, that has been with the surge in all so-called success, at least where Iraq is concerned.
Yeah, you know, the good news is, soldiers, you're leaving Iraq. The bad news is you're going to Afghanistan. I don't see a surge in Afghanistan working in the way that it worked in Iraq, simply because the conditions are different, the issues are different, the people are different. And in Afghanistan, you have basically a mountain people. That's who the Taliban mostly are, the Pashtuns and others, who don't have much else to do with their lives in their villages in the mountains beyond fight whoever the occupier du jour is. And it was the British at one point, then it was the Soviets, and now it's the Americans and other and their allies, including the British. And these people, you know, you can probably make a strong impact by having more troops, but ultimately, time is on the side of the people of the Afghani people. They've never lost a war.
Question from a listener for Mr. Fletcher. There are reports of the Israeli army destroying homes and Palestinian infrastructure in Gaza and the West Bank in response to rocket attacks and suicide bombings. Do the Israelis destroy Palestinian infrastructure on purpose in an effort to break the opposition? It seems to me when you destroy police stations, make it impossible for hospitals to treat people with anything but the most rudimentary method, this only makes Hamas more determined to destroy Israel rather than breaking a people.
You know, there is no Israeli policy to destroy hospitals or schools. I think that's pretty clear. And anybody who knows the Israelis and the way they work, as I do, they take huge pains to avoid killing civilians. But they also drop big bombs in civilian areas, so it's kind of obvious that you're going to kill civilians. And that the whole situation there has to, you know, there is no way out of this except ultimately through negotiations. Which, if they don't go towards peace talks, at least will reach a period of quiet, a kind of truce as they have at the moment. Is Israel destroying Palestinian infrastructure on purpose? Definitely not. Are they turning the screws every time they feel the need to? Definitely yes.
There's a listener named Sahara says, I'm a Palestinian from Jerusalem, currently living in the United States. I want to ask your guest if he also reports the bombings of Palestinian villages and cities done by Israelis killing innocent people. I had family members and friends being killed by Israelis. I got almost killed by Israelis many times. I'm subjected to Israeli discrimination on a daily basis.
Yeah, you know, we try and report from both sides as much as possible. And of course we do. About a month ago, I spent 2 days with a Palestinian farmer in the South Hebron Hills as he was trying to water his sheep and was being stopped by the army only because there was one Jewish settler living on a nearby hilltop. And this farmer had been taking his sheep to the same watering hole for many years. There was one Jewish settler moved in. Suddenly the soldiers stopped him, saying, you can't go there. It's now a closed military area. So I spent a lot of time with that guy telling his story. So, no, we tell both sides of the story.
Lenny, you're our next caller. Welcome.
Thanks. Just wanted to ask, as we are getting done with Bush administration and reflecting on the last 8 years, how was their foreign policy beneficial to Israel? Was it beneficial at all? And what should we expect from Obama's foreign policy as far as Israel is concerned?
Well, the Israeli definition of a good American president is whoever rubber stamps everything we do, that's got to be a good American president. And let's not forget that when George W. Bush became the American president in 2000, Israelis were horrified at the idea that this man, with his strong links to oil and family business links to the Arabs, they feared he would be very much against Israel. Of course, it turned out to be the opposite. So the fears they have today about Obama may be justified, maybe not. We'll just have to see. But the question is whether American president rubber stamping every Israeli action is a good thing for Israel or not, and that's highly debatable.
Here's a listener who writes, why do we invariably hear the right-wing Israeli view in the United States? There is a more sympathetic view alive in Israel regarding the Palestinians, but that perspective never seems to get its due in the American press when certain views are put forward by people. Even as respected as President Carter, the proponents are marginalized. As a non-Jew who is the father of two Jewish children, I am torn by protective instincts and the inherent unfairness of the Palestinian situation. You think he's right about that? Does the press tend to emphasize right-wing Israeli views?
Yeah, no, I think it does. Well, firstly, I think one has to say that the right-wing views get emphasized only because it pertains to settlers, if you like, and extreme statements which get reported. The moderate view seeking an agreement with the Palestinians that is shared by the vast majority of Israelis is actually the view of the Israeli government, and that does get reported a lot.
Can you envision what might occur under an Obama administration? I mean, it seems to be taking shape now. There's likelihood, or certainly a possibility, that Hillary Clinton will be Secretary of State. And any guesses, any wagering on that?
I think if Hillary is Secretary of State, that will reassure many Israelis who are worried about where Obama is going.
But even though she embraced Mrs. Arafat, that's ancient history, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, that was like on a stage. You know, what do you do? You know, you can't always look at, you know, when Obama was with Reverend Wright, you jump up and interrupt him every time, you know.
What's next for Martin Fletcher?
Oh, for me? Another book. I'm hoping this book does well. Breaking news. And, you know, in this book, I was dealing about the dilemmas of being a foreign correspondent to this backdrop of history. What I want to do in my next book is write about Israel. But the very next thing for me, I'm just told by NBC about a half an hour ago, is maybe a warship off the coast of Somalia.
Well, Anderson Cooper says Martin Fletcher has been the gold standard of television war correspondence. And Tom Brokaw says about the book, a stunning and memorable account of reporting from some of the most dangerous places in the world. I found it fascinating. And I thank you for being here. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Martin Fletcher's book, again, is Breaking News. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We thank you for your listenership, and thank you for calling and emailing. We'll be back with you tomorrow. And, in fact, tomorrow we'll be talking about cuts in the CSU system in our opening hour. And in our second hour, we'll be talking about new stem cell research. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Forum's engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.